The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Loneliness is a rich vein for art. How many songs, novels, poems, photographs, and other works have put the painful absence of connection squarely in front of us? The writer Olivia Lang found herself overwhelmed with loneliness after moving from England to New York City for a relationship that ended abruptly. Rather than deny her wish for connection, she dived into the experience of urban isolation and into the lives of several artists whose desolation fueled their work, mainly Edward Hopper, Andy Warhol, David Wojnarowicz, and the outsider artist Henry Darger. Her book is called The Lonely City, Adventures in the Art of Being Alone, and Olivia Lang is with us from a very busy studio in the UK. And Olivia, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
It's lovely to be back. Thank you for having me.
Now, you found yourself alone in New York City after moving there for a relationship that ended very quickly. How did being in the city make the loneliness feel more acute?
I think the thing about being in a city is you're surrounded by people constantly. You're very hyper aware of other people's lives, particularly in a city like New York, where it's very crowded, it's very cramped. You're looking out of your window at an awful lot of other windows. So you have this kind of privileged visual view of people's lives. And if your own life is kind of unpopulated, unfulfilled, you can get strong visual information about how rich other people's lives are. You see people with their husbands and their kids and their wives. And, you know, you're aware that you're kind of the odd one out in that situation. I think one of the hallmarks of the experience of loneliness is a feeling of extreme exposure and shame. And there's something about existing in an urban environment where you feel hyper-exposed to other people's eyes, that you're very much revealed in your state of vulnerable loneliness.
Well, you decided not to deny this essential part of the human condition, the loneliness, but to really dig into it, including doing some research on loneliness. There's a lot, it seems, on the physiological effects, but there's almost this phobic avoidance of loneliness in study, and it gets pathologized in certain ways. How do you think loneliness becomes pathologized?
I think it absolutely does get pathologized. And I mean, the psychological research that's been going on in the last 20 years is really stunningly interesting. And it does tell us a lot about how dangerous loneliness, the experience and feeling of loneliness, can be to the human body. But at the same time, while I was reading all that material, I was noticing how ashamed it often made me feel for being lonely, that it was very normative. It was talking about social connection as the normal state and loneliness as the abnormal state. And I kept thinking, well, you know, an awful lot of people inhabit this state, and often for very good reasons. It's not a shameful or a wrong state to be in. We are all at some point in our lives going to lose people and feel loneliness and longing. That's just part of being human.
And there is a kind of cycle there. I mean, we turn and flee when we get a whiff of loneliness or need from others, especially from strangers, which, as we learn in your book, makes people feel all the more isolated and more aggressive and more angry and less likely to be able to connect.
Absolutely. It's such a vicious cycle. And there's a scene in the book where I'm talking about having encountered somebody at a railway station, an elderly man, when I was kind of in my early 20s, and I was reading a book, and he sat beside me and he kept trying to strike up a conversation. He was smiling. He was pleasant. But the loneliness pouring off him was so absolutely overwhelming that I couldn't really bring myself to speak to him. And I have shame to this day about how poorly I treated him. And I think we've all been familiar with that experience, probably on both sides, of being the one who's lonely and can feel that driving people away, but also of the person who's in a socially contented state and thinks, oh God, this lonely person is just draining me. I can't give them what they need.
You explore artists who look at brokenness and unbelonging and turn it into work. Edward Hopper, Billie Holiday, the outsider artist Henry Darger, Andy Warhol, someone we think of as perpetually surrounded by an entourage of attractive people. What made him a study in loneliness?
Yeah, I think all those people just had so much to, I think they dignified loneliness in their work. I think they made it apparent that it was something worth looking at. And of all of them, Warhol was the one that I was most surprised by. Like you, I see, like all of us, I mean, we see him as the social artist of the 20th century. He really was a consummate socialite. But at the same time, he was somebody who struggled deeply with intimacy, who found that he was incredibly shy, even towards the end of his life. He found contact very hard. He was a gay man. He did have some relationships, but often not as fulfilling as he really wanted them to be. And he, I think, made all kinds of interesting work about loneliness. But the thing that I was most struck by, especially for our sort of 21st century moment, is the way that he used technology and machinery to sort of to handle his own struggle with intimacy. So he would use tape recorders, cameras, film cameras as ways of sort of brokering and buffering connection. They would let him both be close to people, to be able to talk to the people that he wanted to, the beautiful people that he was so attracted to. But at the same time, they let him stare at a bit of a distance. He could go to a party with his camera, and there's Andy with his camera taking photos. He's not vulnerable to, will he stand alone? Will nobody come and talk to him? He's made himself into something else. So the way those machines sort of protect him made me think so much about how we use smartphones and computers in our own times.
Yeah, that's a big theme in the book, that kind of way that we retreat into something else. But something else that struck me, a sort of theme that has to do with Andy Warhol's work, the kind of idea that of the sameness, you know, like he pumps out this art, like, what does he say? All the Cokes are the same and all the Cokes are good, you know?
Yeah,
Coke can be drunk by coal miners and movie stars. And here he is, like, creating this idea that everything could be the same. And there is a sameness outside of loneliness, these cookie-cutter images of how lives are supposed to be, coupled in groups. In fact, I think at one point you call it the shiny factory of monogamy, you know?
So, yeah, I was in a bad mood at the time.
But there's this homogenized world that is tremendously isolating for some of these artists. I'm thinking of David Wanarovich. First, tell us a little bit about him and what is revealed in his work.
He died of AIDS in 1992 at the age of 37, very young. And he'd come from a violent childhood. He'd been homeless. He'd been a sex worker as a very young man. He had experienced society as very isolating. He'd seen the way in which societies can turn on people who don't fit in. In his case, a lot of that was to do with poverty, but also to do with his sexuality. So he was very alert to that. He was very awake to that. And he started making work in his early 20s, began with photography, but he moved out into painting, films. He wrote a wonderful memoir called Close to the Knives, a couple of other books. He was sort of this extraordinarily prolific artist. And then in the late 80s, he was diagnosed with AIDS. One of his closest friends, many of his closest friends died of AIDS, but one of them, the photographer Peter Hooger, died of AIDS. So he was experiencing isolation and loneliness then in a slightly different way, that it was about loss, but it was also about absolutely being demonized. This is the period where politicians are calling for people with AIDS to be tattooed with their status or to be put on islands. And he works to resist that, but also to articulate how these feelings of loneliness aren't necessarily personal responsibility. They're political. They're driven by all sorts of social forces that can be resisted.
We live alone, we die alone, as we hear. But my guest, Olivia Lang, says, I've come to believe that loneliness is not a wholly worthless experience, but one that cuts right to the heart of what we value and what we need. Her new book, Lonely City, explores loneliness, especially the work of artists who are profoundly lonely, but somehow connected through their work. That experience of a really painful or difficult childhood actually runs throughout the lives of some of the artists that you portray, like Henry Darger, who grew up in a home for the feeble-minded. Mm-hmm. He was a hospital janitor who left behind tens of thousands of pages of fiction and artwork. First, how was that discovered?
It's such a sad story, Henry Darger. He lived in a boarding house. He was a really socially isolated man. And just before he died, he, at around the age of 79, I think, he was moved to a Catholic mission home, actually the same mission home that his own father had died in. And he had stayed in this, he lived in this single room for decades and decades. And he was a hoarder, so it was absolutely crammed full of stuff, single shoes, eyeglasses, all these things that he picked up off the streets of Chicago. So understandably, his landlord wanted to clean it out, and he checked with Henry, and Henry was said, you know, you can throw the stuff away. So he got another tenant to help him do it. They got a skip. They started throwing things out. And gradually, as they went through this process, they began to find these paintings of supernatural radiance and strangeness, these extraordinary paintings of small girls. They document a civil war in an alternate world, and they're full of some of them are very beautiful. They have kind of these dragon-like creatures. They have gardens full of flowers. And others show scenes of mass murder and mass torture. They're extremely striking. They're exquisitely coloured, and they're very disturbing. And understandably, again, the landlord was sort of stunned by this work. He had no idea that Darja was an artist, and he had no idea really what to do with it. And it was him that drove Henry Darja's sort of posthumous recognition as one of the really great, unique artists of the 20th century.
The nature of his work, because of these images of little girls, often some of them glorious and heroic, others being killed. A lot of people look at this work and say, you know, that he was a pedophile, he was mentally ill. You seem more forgiving. Why?
I was kind of disturbed to the point almost of being enraged about the way that people spoke for him in his absence, about the way that people demonized him. And I really wanted to get to grips with that. So I spent some time in his archives reading his own journals. I wanted to really understand what his life had been and kind of what evidence there was for these sort of claims, aside from the content of his work, which is, let's remember, artistic work. So I really wanted to try and understand what had happened to him, what his life had involved. And it is just, like you said at the beginning, that there are people who have these fractured childhoods, and his was fractured beyond belief. He was, his mother died when he was very small. He was taken away from his father again when he was very young. He ended up in this home for feeble-minded children. He was an intelligent, clearly intelligent boy. Eventually, he got back to Chicago, and from the age of 17 till well into his 70s, he worked as a janitor, and yet who was astonishingly resourceful and committed in making artwork. He never earned very much money, and yet he managed to gather the resources to make these works, to come up with wonderfully inventive ways of solving problems in his work. And actually, it's very interesting to put him and Warhol together, because they have really similar interests in using pop culture, using images from comics and cartoons, using stuff from newspapers, replicating it, reproducing it, turning it into something else. And I think that sort of side of Darja has been really overwritten by the more salacious material, which there is no evidence for. There's no evidence that he was a pedophile or a serial killer. Absolutely zero.
Well, Darja did consider himself an artist, but he wanted his work burned, you know, and it's work that he obviously spent so much time on. But like you, you know, people get repelled by it until they dive in deeper. Mm-hmm. Hopper's paintings may be the same way. And I'm thinking, you know, Wanarovich, you know, craving human connection, but maybe not knowing quite how to do it and removed by his camera. There's this kind of push and pull tension with all of the artists that you look at. You know, they so want to connect with other people. So are we answering them? Are we connecting by looking at this work, by thinking about it, by talking about it?
When we're talking about loneliness, we often think that the solution is to find a relationship. And that, sure, there's truth in that, absolutely. But so much of it is a desire to be heard, to have our interiors seen in some way. And I think this is where art fits in, that people can communicate things that they can't necessarily say to another person into their artwork. And a person can see that artwork and be touched by it. And I found the expressions of loss, of hunger, of longing in these people's artwork incredibly healing, because it made me realise that my feelings weren't so strange after all, that there were other people who'd felt the same way. It dissolved the shame that I felt around my loneliness.
Well, how about you? I mean, you created this work about dwelling in loneliness, right? Breaking your own taboos and stigmas around loneliness and shame.
Yeah.
And coming to the other side of this, do you ever feel, you know, grateful to this man who so abruptly changed your life by backing out of this relationship in New York?
Wow, that's such an interesting question, because actually, if you'd asked me that even a week ago, I would have said no. And I think because I've been having to think about it so intensively over the last sort of, you know, the publication moment. Yes, I think I had an astonishing few years, a very painful few years, but I'm so grateful for being kind of smashed open enough to be able to have felt all of this and to have gone to those places. It really has been a blessing in a weird way.
Olivia Lang, thank you so much for speaking with us.
A great pleasure.
Olivia Lang is the author of The Trip to Echo Spring and most recently The Lonely City, Adventures in the Art of Being Alone. There's a link to more on the book, including what I think is a keenly accurate review by Fresh Air's book critic Maureen Corrigan. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the early and mid-20th century, hotels, airlines, and travel agencies used full-color travel posters to inspire customers to dream about that once-in-a-lifetime vacation, to finally book that trip to an exotic locale. Now, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory has resurrected the old-school travel poster. JPL recently launched a new series of dazzling space travel posters that harken back to the golden age of airline travel to encourage people to imagine a future where touring the historic sites of Mars or visiting more than 100 breathtaking geysers on the tiny Saturnian moon Enceladus could be on your short list for spring break. Don and Ryan Clark are the brothers behind Invisible Creature. It's a design and illustration studio based in Seattle that designed three of the posters for JPL's Vision of the Future series. And Don Clark is with us now to talk about the project. Don, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So how did you get this gig first with JPL to design the posters?
Yeah, that seems to be the golden question. Actually, it came from a friend of mine who is a visual strategist at NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California. Both of us have music backgrounds. We were both in bands and toured kind of back in the day, like, you know, 15 years ago. And we've just kind of kept in touch over the years. And he asked if we wanted to work on this, a few posters in this series. So it was just kind of a no-brainer. We jumped at it.
Well, of course, anybody would, but lest anyone thinks it's nepotism, you have a very well-established career and studio at Invisible Creature. And also a little bit of this runs in the family. I guess your grandfather, Alfred Paulsen, actually did work for NASA as well. What'd he do?
He was a graphic designer and illustrator, much more of an illustrator, I would say. But yeah, for over 30 years, he worked at Ames Research Center at Moffett Field. And it's funny, when I got the call from Joby at JPL about the project, and I was like, gosh, you know, did you have any, you know, did I ever tell you about my grandfather and his history and our family's history? And he's like, no. So it was interesting. No one knew about this. And so when it came kind of full circle and we were working on something for NASA, the family obviously just kind of freaked out, and it was a lot of fun.
Quite something. So what kind of direction did you get? I mean, visions of the future are pretty wide open compared to the mid-century. When I went back and looked at some of those old NASA posters, you know, people are wearing regular suits and ties, you know, riding what looks like the monorail. It was a very contained vision. So what did they tell you?
Yeah, the idea is that these posters would be inspired by, you know, vintage mid-century or WPA style posters. But the big concept was, what would they look like 500 years from now? So specifically with Mars, if you were to go visit the historic sites of Mars, what would those be? You'd go see where the rovers, where they've been, maybe where we first found water, agriculture, populating the planet, architecture. So that's kind of the idea is, yes, we're inspired by that era of work, but we're fast forwarding hundreds of years in the future.
You got to make something that really lasts if you're talking about 500 years.
Exactly. And, you know, we throw around the word timeless a lot, but that's really an important thing for us is we don't always, you know, hit a home run with our projects, but we do always hope that our work is something that doesn't feel like now or 5 years ago. And, you know, we really want we do want it to last.
Well, you've got three posters, as you mentioned, in the series, one called The Grand Tour, Enceladus, and Mars. So what does The Grand Tour commemorate?
It was part of the, actually ended up being part of the Voyager mission, but every 175 years, they found out that the alignment of Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus and Neptune were all in one. They were aligned. So you could technically go see all four of those on one mission. The Voyager mission, I believe, just ended up being Jupiter and Saturn, if I'm not mistaken. that's the idea there, is that, you know, in the future, every 175 years, you could take your personal ship or maybe take a tour ship and go visit these planets. And so that's the idea.
Well, that poster is just full of motion. You see these planets kind of in alignment and all these various different spacecraft ships whizzing by and the lines following them. But the image for Enceladus is much more, I guess, peaceful. What is it that you were doing with that poster?
I think the idea here is that, you know, we wanted to show these strong icy geysers that are shooting out of the moon. And that was something that NASA wanted to see. But the idea is that you can visit that in the future. And so we kind of came up with this idea that this is like a solo ship that maybe this man had designed and, you know, years before. And so this is maybe is his final run to go visit Enceladus. So it's funny, we actually took the dog out at one point, and then NASA wanted, you know, to see him back in there. So yeah, that was a fun one.
The other thing about this is these are available by download in high resolution for free. So you're basically creating these posters to give away. Is this something you've done before?
You know, it's not. This is our first public domain project. We were hired by NASA to work on these, but they are available for free to download from their website. We did three of them. They have also allowed us to sell our own limited prints that are signed by us. So we have those available as well. But yeah. They can be yours for free.
You mentioned before that this was right in your wheelhouse, sort of this mid-century design, this kind of old-school travel poster, as well as portraying the future. But I'm thinking, you know, 50s, 60s, these were the golden years of the space program when people were thinking about space. It was a part of their thinking and a kind of goal. Are you trying to recapture or reignite that feeling?
I think so. I think with everything that we do, that there's that little lightning in a bottle that we're trying to capture. And when you look at something from that era, I think your mind instantly takes you back. And even if it's subconscious, you can't articulate it, you instantly know that it's optimistic. It was a time when, you know, cars were looking like spaceships anything was possible. So that is the era that I love so much because it is so optimistic. It was such a fertile time for amazing design, whether it was architecture, illustration, graphic design, music. The arts were so great in that era. And that era for me spans about 50 years, you know, you could say from even the 20s to the 70s. So that really is our world.
Don, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's been fun.
Don Clark, he's co-founder, along with his brother Ryan, of Invisible Creature. That's a design and illustration studio, and they're based in Seattle. They designed three of the 14 posters for JPL's Visions of the Future series. Now, we do have a link so you can see and download all of the posters. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. NASA's Visions of the Future poster series is not the only way the organization is taking advantage of its retro appeal. Word of Mouth producer Molly Donahue brings us this story on the evolution of NASA's logo and its sometimes bumpy history.
Scott Kelly, the astronaut, can't wait any longer to get back to Earth.
The American astronaut who spent nearly a year in space is back on Earth this morning.
Thumbs up.
We got a great view of him now. Folks here in Mission Control Houston letting out a very big cheer.
Recently, astronaut Scott Kelly returned to Earth after a year in space, breaking the continuous and cumulative spaceflight records and bumping NASA to the front of the news cycle. Images of his return splashed across the front pages of newspapers and blogs, showing Scott Kelly wrapped snugly in a big blue woolen blanket, propped in a chair in a field in Kazakhstan. His body, dwarfed by his oversized white spacesuit, and emblazoned on his left pocket, NASA's famous red and blue logo. A logo with a long history. But where did it come from? For that, we need to go back to 1959, when the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration first merged.
We have one of the most challenging assignments that has ever been given to modern man. I'm not going to take time to read the act verbatim, but it does say this about our mission. And I say to you that it is well worth reading, and I'm sure you'll find that copies are available to you.
With the merger came an opportunity to brand NASA for the general public, with something that could be used on everything from stationary to aircraft. They came up with something you're probably pretty familiar with.
And the main elements were that it was a round circle with orbital elements to show the future and the stars in the background to show. So the round blue ball part of it was supposed to be the Earth. And then there was this red wing on it.
That's NASA's chief historian, Bill Berry, and he's describing what's lovingly referred to as the meatball.
It's been a subject of considerable controversy over the years about what it really is, but we now know it was actually a supersonic wing design, but there's been confusion about why it appears that way. But that's the famous red sort of swoosh that NASA has on the insignia.
Created in 1959 by NASA designer James Mottarelli, NASA employees took to the insignia quickly. The decade that followed was easily NASA's heyday. In 1961, just 2 years after NASA became the agency we recognize today, President Kennedy delivered a special message to Congress.
Commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
That's from the same year Alan Shepard became the first American to go into space. 8 years later, 1969, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon, an achievement that was unprecedented. But it left the United States feeling at a loss. What is there left to do when you've achieved the impossible?
There was a large and expensive program, very clear direction from the president to go, you know, land on the moon and come back in a decade. Those days were over. It took a while for that to become clear. The Nixon administration was not in a big hurry to make a decision and make clear what their policy was.
With the accomplishments of the past casting a long shadow, NASA needed a reboot and a new logo. By now, it was 1972, and design was being taken very seriously in Washington. Anyone who has been to the Capitol can attest that examples of brutalist architecture, like the J. Edgar Hoover Building, have already outlived many of the mid-century designers who vouched for their aesthetic appeal. In the same vein, the National Endowment for the Arts developed the Federal Design Improvement Program, and President Nixon urged federal agencies to join in on the effort by considering whether their organizations could benefit from better graphics. Under the mandate of the newly created Federal Graphics Improvement Program, the New York firm Dan & Blackburn, the same people who designed the National Bicentennial logo, started working on a new logo for NASA and rolled it out in 1975.
The public thought it was a pretty cool design, and it is a cool design. It's beautifully modern, stripped down. It sort of captured the essence of NASA, I think, as far as the public was concerned. But NASA employees were very unhappy with it.
The new design pared the logo type down to four streamlined letters, NASA. There were no hard angles, only curves meant to evoke fluidity, and the A's were even missing their crossbars. Meanwhile, few people even knew that a redesign was underway. And the way NASA is organized,
sort of their own little fiefdoms out there,
that system meant that 10 center directors, used to working independently from headquarters, walked into work one day to find a memo telling them that the insignia that had accompanied the United States first into space and then to the moon, the insignia that had helped distinguish America as a leader in space travel, that insignia had been retired to make space for
what was derisively known as the worm among NASA employees.
And the worm remained for the next decade and a half, a troubled time span in NASA's history.
You have to remember the historical context on this. NASA had the Challenger accident happened in the late 80s. In the early 90s, we deployed the Hubble Space Telescope, and although we all love the Hubble Space Telescope now, and it's a wonderful instrument, when it was first deployed, there was an error in the mirror, and so the Hubble Space Telescope didn't deliver the quality of pictures that was originally expected. So there's a number of significant blows like that that had happened to the agency.
In 1992, a new NASA administrator was brought in to address performance problems. On a visit to Langley Research Center, which had resisted displaying the worm insignia on its hangar doors until late 1991, Dan Golden was advised the first and most important thing he could do to boost employee morale, condemn the worm.
And Golden was kind of taken aback, but he's listened to a lot of folks around him, and they all said the same thing. And he arrived on a Thursday, it was May 22nd, 1992, and by Friday he had announced that NASA was getting rid of the logotype, the worm, and readopting the NASA meatball.
In an effort to reduce costs, items like stationery were changed back gradually, and aircraft would be repainted at a normal recycle time. But a change in spirit was tangible. Talking to the NASA organization, Administrator Golden said, "The can-do spirit of the past is alive and well. The magic is back." It seems like a big job for a logo.
That the meatball identifies the agency and all that tradition and example and history teaches us about that organization. And we're now the ones carrying that identity into the future, and hopefully we're making as great a contribution as our predecessors did.
According to those who see it every day as they head into work, the logo does inspire us to reach further into the future and look to the past only for inspiration.
Got to realize there's a fundamental truth to our nature. Man must explore. And this is exploration at its greatest.
For Word of Mouth, this is Molly Donahue.
And we continue our look into the future and history of space travel with a story from the mid-1950s. Just before NASA was created, the U.S. Air Force began testing the effects of high speeds on the human body. Alton Yates was part of a small group of volunteers who were strapped to rocket-propelled sleds that hurtled down a track at more than 600 miles per hour. These experiments helped prove that space travel was safe for humans. At StoryCorps, Yates told his daughter, Toni, how he came to be a pioneer in the space program when he was just out of high school.
My dad was trying to raise the seven of us by himself. And I knew that as soon as I finished high school, I was going to have to help with taking care of the family.
How did you know he needed your help?
Well, he came home from work and he rolled cigarettes, he roasted peanuts and put them in little bags, and then he left home immediately to sell those products. And I just couldn't stand to see him continue to do that. There weren't any good paying jobs just out of high school, so I decided to join the Air Force. And a call had gone out for volunteers to determine the effects of space travel on the human body. So I became one of the human guinea pigs who rode high-speed rocket sleds.
How old were you when you did the first test?
I was 19. When the sled took off, it was almost as if everything in your body was being forced out through your back. And then when it stopped, it was like driving an automobile at 100 miles an hour and running into a stone wall.
But yet you did that 65 times?
I did it more than 65 times. And let me tell you, there was something about the group of volunteers. I remember one, when they took him off the sled, he was like a dish rag. The rest of us saw what happened to him, but we were anxious to get strapped into that seat to conduct the next experiment. We went up to Johnsville, Pennsylvania. They had a huge centrifuge up there. We rode that thing at high speeds, and you had your hand on a little trigger. And the minute you started to black out, your hand would come off the trigger, and that would stop the centrifuge.
Did your dad know what you were doing?
He didn't know initially, but Ebony magazine published an article that showed pictures of some of these rocket sleds that I had been riding. When my dad got a copy of that magazine, he took that thing everywhere he went. And I think to make my father proud of me was something that I've always wanted to do. And I was able to do that before he passed away.
The day that man went into space, what was that like for you?
I felt a warmth that came over my body when I heard the countdown. And even to this day, every time there's a liftoff, I think a little piece of me lifts off with each one of those missions.
That's Alton Yates with his daughter Toni at StoryCorps in Jacksonville, Florida. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Amid the barrage of best of lists at the end of last year, the Word of Mouth team shared some of our favorite audio picks from 2015. And that list included moments from comedy podcasts, some multimedia websites, and public radio programs. We had such a blast doing it and such a good response that we thought we'd expand it to a monthly feature, sharing bits of lost and found sound that is available for anybody to listen to online. So the entire Word of Mouth crew is here with some great sounds at the ready. Producers Logan Shannon, Maureen McMurray, Molly Donahue, and Taylor Quimby are here with me. And Logan, we're going to start with you.
Okay, that sounds great. So one thing that we do on the show oftentimes when we're putting the show together is we pick a piece of music to go as the outro music for a particular piece. And this past week we did an interview with Jason Scott, who's from the Internet Archive, and he is curating something called the Malware Museum, which is collecting viruses that people can see safely. So here's a little clip from that interview.
One of the things about viruses is that they're thought of as being destructive, and some of them weren't destructive. They just simply worked to put themselves in everything on every machine.
And so I was trying to find something that was sort of computer related, which sometimes this works and sometimes it doesn't. So I typed in computer into the search function of Spotify, and I found this really great song from the 80s.
Oh yeah. Computer love is not what you that is not what you think of as like your go-to theme for a sexy romance song.
No, but there's something about the use of the, it's called a vocoder, right?
A vocoder, yeah.
A vocoder, and just like the really awesome beat. I did not use it for the piece because it was somehow just like a little too distracting, but I thought it would be, this is the perfect place to share that piece of musical genius.
I feel so much better having listened to that piece of music. That's a great start. Okay, how about you, Taylor? What have you got?
So you know how it seems like there's a lot of viral videos of people playing music, and it's not just the music itself that's sort of interesting, it's the process of how it's being made. So this is one of those types of videos. It is this guy from Sweden. He's a composer. His name is Martin Molin, and he made this huge machine, this crazy contraption. It looks very much like something from The Grinch, the Dr. Seuss cartoon, you know, where they're like, you bring out your bamboozles and your schnozzles and your floozles. And there's all these like
Does
weird...
Does he have a curled up nose?
he is very fashionably dressed. But anyway, so he's got this big, crazy machine, and it uses marbles to make this incredible song. Even the drums, he's got a bass attached to it. It's a really wild contraption.
So he's making the marbles hit a bell?
So it's got a huge crank, and the crank brings up marbles from the back of the machine, almost like a steamship, you know, bringing water up and around the top. And then it goes into this sort of thing in the top, and then they go down and they're hitting vibraphone panels. The drum you hear is marbles hitting a drum pad. And he is manually cranking this and changing levers that like do different parts of the song.
While playing the bass?
Yeah. So this is, it's funny, the reason I wanted to play this was because I often think about, with these videos, whether or not it's that interesting to listen to without watching the video. You know, music is music. There's a performance aspect of it, of course, but like when you watch this video, you're just like thrilled. You cannot take your eyes away. But listening to it, I mean, I like it, but the thrill is really seeing it. Maybe this was a bad example for the first radio thing. Oh no.
Needs visual.
All right, watch the video. It'll be online. Virginia, what do you have?
This is a piece of sound that I've been trying to get more people to listen to for a long time, so I'm sort of like using this excuse to do that. So I don't know if you guys know this, but Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ, was one of the historians writing about him said that he wielded the telephone like an assault weapon. He used the telephone all the time. You know, he was always screaming down people at the phone. He had, after JFK died, he had like three lines put in. And on the very night he came home from Dallas after being sworn in, after JFK's assassination, had his text put in a device that taped his phone calls. So we hear all of his phone calls after the JFK assassination, a bunch to Jackie Kennedy, and his policy stuff, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin, the Civil Rights Act. But we also hear LBJ just being LBJ. And this is an example. He's calling the head of Haeger Slacks. They made polyester slacks mostly,
yeah.
I think, in
their
Texas.
But
they still do, I guess. And he was calling the head, Joe Haeger. It was summertime, August 1964, and he's ordering a pair of slacks from Joe Haeger.
I want them a half an inch larger in the waist than they were before, except I want 2 or 3 inches of stuff left back in there so I can take them up. I vary 10 or 15 pounds a month.
A month?
A month?
So, it gets better.
Leave me at least 2.5 to 3 inches in the back where I can let them out or take them up, and put it, make these a half inch bigger in the waist, make the pockets at least an inch longer. Money, my money and my knife, everything fall out. Wait just a minute. Hello? Now, another thing, the crotch down where your nuts hang is always a little too tight. So when you make them up, give me an inch that I can let out there because they cut me. They're just like riding a wire fence. These are almost, these are the best that I've had anywhere in the United States. But when I gain a little weight, they cut me under there. So leave me, you never do have much margin there. Let's see if you can't leave me about it. An inch from the, where the zipper ends, around under my, back to my bunghole.
So I mean, you know, all right, so we've heard about, you know, that he was a crude guy, that he used to talk to his staff members while he was on the toilet, that kind of thing. But this, you know, like in an age when we're talking about transparency among our politicians and they're striving for that by giving them slices of their life, this is an absolute unvarnished president. And I think if when considering his whole legacy, it's a really interesting thing to consider.
15 to 20 pounds
a month?
Yeah. How does that happen?
All right, we've got the whole word of mouth crew here sharing some of their choice audio picks. I just shared mine, which was LBJ sounding somewhat unpresidential while ordering some specially made slacks. Who wants to follow that?
I guess I will. So I listened to a new podcast this week. I listened to it because Breakmaster Cylinder, one of our favorites, did the song for it, which is the second half in their Maureen. So that's just, that's a sort of creepy feeling.
Yeah.
But then it's a really cool podcast because it's people sitting down in a room and telling horrible secrets from their past.
What's it called?
The Secret Room.
And so why do you think that you've decided to share your secret in the Secret Room today?
One, it's a heck of a secret. But two, I think it's sort of a way of exorcising that particular bad thing that I did to someone.
That's a woman, by the way.
Finally, live.
Is her voice?
Yeah.
Her voice.
Be okay with just learning from that experience and moving on. He's long since moved on, I'm sure.
So, do you think maybe it's time to move the mug?
It's a nice mug. You know,
I want to reveal the secret of this episode.
Yeah, it's in the back of the cupboard.
But she did something terrible to this man.
You know, I see it, and I don't know.
So the mug's going to stay there?
Probably.
Okay. All right. If you were to run into him today, do you think he might have something new to say?
No.
He just let sleeping dogs lie.
Yes. Maybe you lost weight, you gain weight. Good to see you. And that's it.
And that is it. Okay. Maybe he'll hear the podcast and he won't even know it's about him.
Oh, he'll know.
Oh, you think so?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll see
Snap
if he pops up
at
on
the
instant
end.
Messenger.
Oh, he'll know. Reminds me of that, you know, the post secrets, the postcards.
Yeah.
But someone daring to say them out loud, I guess manipulating their voice would be perfect cover.
It seems like an audio version and like a more produced version of Post Secret.
Okay, Maureen has been kind enough to engineer today, so she's all the way in the other room. So what do you got, Maureen?
I have a recording of an opera singer from the early 1900s. Now, a little bit of background. This woman was a socialite. She was part of all of these women's groups. She lived in New York City, and her performances, though, they were very, very small, and it was extremely difficult to get tickets and to get in to see the singer. She's incredibly popular. She started singing in 1912, and then in 1946, she performed at Carnegie Hall and sold out weeks before the performance. All of these famous people came in, Cole Porter, and just came to see this woman because it was so rare. And the reason why she was popular is because her name is Florence Foster Jenkins. Is because she was really bad. So I'm going to play a clip from a record of her singing. And let me see what it's an aria, a Mozart aria in 1945. It's like if I sang an opera.
Were they just making fun of her by going?
So here's the thing. And actually, there's going to be a movie made of her life. Meryl Streep is going to be playing this woman, Florence Foster Jenkins, in the movie. So she grew up in Pennsylvania, was a piano prodigy, and came to New York, started teaching classes, piano classes. She had a hand injury and decided that she wanted to become a singer. And quickly, other people discovered that she could not carry a tune, had no sense of rhythm. But I guess she held on and just never realized that she was not good. Now, the thing that makes this even sadder is that she contracted syphilis from her husband, and that is thought to be the reason why she couldn't carry a tune, is that it was just her nervous system. And then all of the treatments, this was before penicillin, just made it so she not only couldn't carry a tune, but didn't know she couldn't carry a tune. So it's this kind of sad thing where...
Did anyone tell her?
The thing is, she never had reviews of when she was performing for these small groups and these private clubs. But finally, when she, you know, relented, and I think it was in 1946 or 45 when she went to Carnegie Hall, that's when people were able to review it, and she was kind of torn to shreds. But there are some people who claim that they had a genuine, like, love of her music, and they weren't poking fun, that they just enjoyed listening to her. I'm sorry. I got my facts wrong. It was 1944, and then she died the next year.
Oh, Florence.
I'm sorry. I just shared this horrible, like, depressing
story. Such a downer. Let's play more computer love.
You know what I mean? Okay, wait. We'll go out on computer love.
All right, plenty to choose from. Word of Mouth producers Logan Shannon, Maureen McMurray, Molly Donahue, and Taylor Quimby here with me offering our monthly audio picks. You can find links to listen to all of them on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And let us know which great things you've heard recently by leaving something on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. Thank you so much for listening today. And if you can't catch Word of Mouth during the week, you can always catch up using the Word of Mouth podcast. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to iTunes or Stitcher or Audioboom, wherever you get your podcasts, and search Word of Mouth NHPR. And if you like the podcast, take a moment and rate it. It'll help other people find it. And it's all the better when things are shared by Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue and Logan Shannon.
Our senior producer is Taylor Quimby.
And our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of
New Hampshire Public Radio.